Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. In letter 74, Seneca is providing us readers with some helpful insights about virtue and why, from the Stoic perspective, virtue is really the only good, even though we talk about many other things as being goods. And it's worth reminding ourselves about something that he's taking for granted as he's making all of his arguments and exhortations in this, and that is when we view something as good, because of the way we are, we're naturally drawn to desire it, to try to obtain it, to protect it when we have it. And when we see something correlatively as bad or as evil, we're going to try to avoid it. And so the question is, what is the genuine good? Because we want to orient ourselves properly. If we don't, there's going to be some bad consequences for us. And so he talks about this. Now, before we go into this, we want to clarify terminology a little bit. So in this translation, we have that the only genuine good is honorable conduct, right? But it could also be translated as just the honorable. And the two Latin terms that are being used there are good, bonum, this classification, right? Things that are good in whatever sense we're going to talk about. And then the Stoics say the only thing that really is genuinely good, the only thing that deserves the name of good, is what in Latin they call the honestum, the word that we get honest from. And, you know, over the years that has come to take on a connotation of just being about truth, but it really has to do with all of our conduct. So an honest person is somebody who behaves the way that they ought to, sort of across the board for the Stoics. So what they're asserting here is that the only thing that really is good is whatever counts as honestum, whatever is honorable. And that is going to turn out to be the virtues and virtuous actions and also virtuous people. So what happens if you don't view things this way? He says that he who regards other things as good is dominated by fortune and subject to another's whim. He who limits goodness to what is honorable is happy within himself. Now, this term fortune is going to come up over and over again here. And again, a little bit of clarification is probably necessary. When the ancients are talking about fortune, they don't just mean the individual fortune that you wind up with. We typically think of a fortune as riches, right? But it could be all sorts of other things. They talked about fortune or fortuna in Latin as being sort of, it could be a goddess, or it could be just this cosmic process that allots different things to different people and does so in a kind of random way. So if we're thinking about money, you know, some people get money, some people don't get money. Other people get good health and other people get bad health. And you can ask yourself, well, why did I get cancer? Dumb luck, you know? Or it could be the fact that you smoke 4 packs a day. That might have a little bit to do with it. Or you might have been the poor person who lived upstairs from the chimney smoke person who's going through 4 packs a day and you had secondhand smoke. All of these things that are kind of random are fortune. So if we think about what things that we typically call goods are subject to fortune and which ones aren't, we see here that we're laying ourselves in for some real problems. And I'll just give you a few examples that he brings up. One person is grieved when his children die, understandably, right? I think all of us can relate to that in some way. Worried when they're sick. Another is sad when they're of base character and tinged with notoriety. This fellow is racked with love for another's wife. This one with love for his own. Now notice that example. So this poor, miserable guy over here is desiring somebody else's wife. And so he's got a lot of, you know, troubles trying to seduce her and not get, you know, caught by the jealous husband and turn into a sitcom or something like that. But this guy over here just happens to feel that same level of desire for his own wife. I mean, she might not return his affections. Or maybe there's, you know, things that impede and impinge. They're stuck across the ocean from each other. Whatever it is, his desire is going to be unsatisfied. And because of that, he's going to be unhappy. And he says, of all the suffering crowds of humankind, the greatest of those who are troubled by the thought of death. like troops passing through enemy territory. They must be looking around all the time. Unless this fear is driven from the breast, we live with quaking hearts. So, you know, so long as we're viewing all sorts of other things as goods, which the Stoics say are not genuine goods, we're actually going to be unhappy. We're going to be subject to fortune because we're waiting for things to come to us. We're going to be miserable. And he's got this great metaphor here. He says, set before yourself the following image. Fortune is putting on a festival. Elected office, wealth, popularity. That, those are the things that fortune is distributing through the crowd. Some of this largesse is torn to bits by many grasping hands, some shared out in faithless bargains, some carried off to the detriment of those who get it. Some of that falls to the inattentive. Some is knocked away by those trying too eagerly to snatch it. Even when luck attends the catching, none of it brings anyone a joy that lasts even till tomorrow. The intelligent person, what are they going to do? They're going to look at this and be like, well, I'm getting out of here, right? They know that small favors may come at a high price. He says, no one is grappling with him as he's leaving. No one throws a punch as he's headed for the door. Everybody's scuffling around all the loot. The same thing, he says, happens with the gifts that fortune showers upon us. Poor things, we're all in a fever and in a fret. We wish we had many hands. Isn't that a wonderful metaphor? Two hands are not enough to snatch at all the great stuff that's coming our way and push off the other people so they don't get their grubby hands on it. That's not to be happy. I mean, unless you really just love competing with people, then that, I suppose, could make you happy in a sense. So he says, when these gifts come, we think they're too slow in coming. They come to so few, though all expect them. We want to be where they're falling. We rejoice if we catch a few where others have been disappointed. And so he says, you know, the person who's determined to be happy can't take that point of view. They need to make up their mind instead that the only thing that's really genuinely good for us is virtue, is honorable conduct. So it's a narrowing of scope of what actually counts as the good. He gives us a number of arguments, what you could call considerations for why we should accept this point of view that he's putting forth, that of the Stoics. So the first one has to do with thinking ill of providence. And this may not be very convincing to a modern audience. He says, if he imagines that there's any other good, he thinks ill of providence since many uncomfortable things happen to just men, and whatever gifts we do receive are small and brief duration compared to the age of the universe. It is in consequence of this complaint that we are such thankless interpreters of the divine. We complain our blessings are not ours forever, and, you know, so all of that. If we really took the right point of view, and we do think that there is some sort of providential ordering of things, and we see the fact that, you know, a lot of just people or good people don't get good outcomes, and a lot of, by opposition, a lot of bad people get good things, or things that at least we're calling good, maybe we shouldn't call those things good. Maybe we shouldn't view money or income or notoriety or celebrity as genuine goods. I mean, if any old schmuck can get them just because they're happening to be worked out in that way by whatever providence is and fortune working with providence in some unknown way, then we probably shouldn't view them as goods. If we're going to view them as goods, then providence sucks. Providence is terribly arranged, whether it's God or something else, divine mind. It's not doing a good job. So if we want to say that it is doing a good job, we'd better restrict the goods that we're calling good. Again, probably not that convincing to many modern interpreters. Here's another more powerful position. Virtue lacks nothing, he says at a couple different points. Says, do you ask why virtue lacks nothing? Virtue rejoices in present goods, has no longing for what is absent, finds nothing meager that will suffice. Abandon this attitude, loyalty is lost, integrity is lost. To preserve these values, you have to endure many things that are regarded as bad. Gone is courage, gone is greatness of spirit, right? Gratitude is lost and readiness. So virtue is satisfied with what's there. A little bit later on, he says, virtue leaves no space empty. It occupies the entire mind. Virtue by itself is enough, for it has within it the strength and source of good things. So this is a way of saying, if you actually do have virtue, not just, you know, the semblance of virtue, not just saying that virtue is a good thing. If you actually commit yourself to it and you develop virtue within you, Stoic virtues of wisdom, fortitude or courage, temperance or moderation, and justice, you will already have your reward because virtue is the good. So that's an argument that they give. Another one that's really interesting is this consideration of the human being as kind of poised between the divine and the animal. And what Seneca has to say here is really quite clever. So we've got, let's say, two different kinds of potential goods. He's going to say one of these is not actually good. We've got things that we recognize as intrinsically good, like virtues, right, and virtuous behavior, the honestum, the honorable. And then we've got all these other things that human beings consider good, like, you know, let's be really crude with this, partying, eating lots of good food, getting laid, having a good time, all that sort of stuff. Here's where the argument goes, and it's really quite interesting. So the gods are above, or the divine, or whatever it is, and animals are below. Now, human beings can enjoy both of these sorts of things, the virtues and all these other creature comforts, let's call them, right? Who else enjoys creature comforts? It's not the gods. They don't have anything of that, right? It's animals. And who enjoys the intrinsically good, virtue? It's the gods. The animals have nothing of that. Now, here's where Seneca's going with this. Are you going to say that the gods are in some respect lacking compared to human beings? Because human beings can savor the, you know, the taste of a wonderful pizza. The gods don't care about that sort of stuff. So is the position of the gods somehow worse off than that of the humans? I mean, if these things are goods, that's what you're saying. Or if we go the other way and we want to say these things are goods, animals seem to be enjoying them way more than we do. He says this, animals partake of food more eagerly, are less exhausted by sexual intercourse, have greater and more consistent strength. Therefore, they must be happier than human beings. If we want to think about distinctively human happiness, maybe we need to locate it in virtue, not in all these creature comforts, right? That's a really interesting argument that he's giving there. Almost immediately after that, he makes a really helpful clarification. Well, you know, if people call these things goods, what's going on here? Why would they call something good that's not actually good? And here the translation is that these are actually not goods as such. These are comforts. He says, the goods that reason gives are real. They're solid and eternal. They cannot fail. They cannot decrease or be diminished. Those others are the goods of opinion. Goods of opinion. They're not real goods. They're what in other places we call apparent goods. And they share their name with real goods, but the distinctive property of the good is not in them. For this reason, he says, let them be termed comforts, or to use our school's terminology, preferred things. And comforts is translating commoda, things that are, you know, useful for us, things that are satisfying to our bodies, things that may be gratifying to our minds as well, but they're not the genuine good. They don't have the good within them as such. They're only, you might say, good for something. So, you know, like eating tasty food is good for the tongue and perhaps good for the spirit in a certain way. It cheers you up a little bit. We can talk about comfort food. If we just stick with food, right? All sorts of great examples. We got the rich food of a banquet. We have the food that's better for our body. We have the comfort food that we turn to when we're feeling blue, like the person in the movie eating from a gallon of ice cream in front of the refrigerator without a bowl. And we could multiply examples of this, right? The Stoics call those things preferred indifference, not preferred goods, preferred indifference. And they say that they have some value to them, but it's not the kind of value that is that of the good as such. It's not anything that it has to do with virtue. But they can be used virtuously. We can use these things rightly. It doesn't mean that we have to suddenly become ascetics and say, I will have nothing to do with anything that's not virtue itself. No, we can use these things properly. Using them properly means recognizing that they are fleeting, that we may not be able to hold on to them forever, and that our happiness does not lie in them. Here's where we get to a really interesting discussion. And here's where he says, yeah, a lot of people talk to the Stoics and they say, this is a real problem for you. This armament will not make you safe from fortune and invulnerable. For among goods, your school includes devoted children, good customs in one's homeland, and good parents. When those are endangered, you cannot look on with anxiety. You will be disturbed by an attack on your homeland, the death of your children, or the enslavement of your parents. Sounds like a pretty good point, doesn't it? The Stoics do, in fact, say, well, yes, the core of good is virtue, but, you know, these other things are good by a kind of extension. Doesn't that now make them vulnerable to the world? In a way, that seems to go against Stoic philosophy. And he says, in my reply, I'm going to set down the points that we make on behalf of our school, then a further response, I think, needs to be made. So here's the Stoic response. The situation is different with those things whose loss means they're replaced by some discomfort. The example, when health is ruined, it turns into its opposite, ill health. When keen eyesight is extinguished, we are afflicted with blindness. When the tendons of the knee are cut, we not only lose the ability to run quickly, but become lame as well. But with the objects I mentioned just now, parents, children, homeland, there is no such risk. If I've lost a good friend, I need not suffer disloyalty in his place. If my good children have died and if neglectful ones do not succeed them, that may not be that great of an argument when you hear it. Another is that he says, in these cases, it's not the friends or the children that are lost, but only their bodies. Isn't that an interesting thing for a Stoic, who's a materialist, to say? He says, well, if one's friends have perished and children of proven worth have also perished, we have something to fill the void. What is this thing that fills the void? The same thing that made them good, virtue. Now, that's a really interesting consideration because virtue seems to be something very abstract. How does that satisfy your sense of loss of a human being? Presumably, the virtue must be kind of individuated. The virtue of my daughter, if I'm Cicero thinking about Tullia, right? The virtue of this good friend, if I've lost a good friend. So there's an interesting consideration. And then he goes on and he says, what are you saying? How can a person not be happier when surrounded by a crowd of friends and children? And here Seneca says, let's think about a circle, right? If it's a big circle or a little circle, it's still a circle. It still has the same shape. It's still what it is. And he goes on and says, sometimes virtue expands its scope. It rules kingdoms, cities, provinces, looks after friendships, performs various responsibilities among neighbors and children. Other times it's enclosed within a tight boundary of poverty, exile, or bereavement. But it's not made smaller when brought down to earth from a loftier pinnacle, from the estate of kings to that of the private citizen, to the limitations of a single household or even a corner. It's equally great even if it withdraws into itself, closed off on every side. And then he says, okay, so those are the arguments the Stoics make. Here's my own account. The wise person is not afflicted by the loss of children or friends because he endures their death in the same spirit as he awaits his own. He does not fear the one any more than he grieves over the other, for virtue is made of consistency. All its actions harmonize and agree with each other, and this is lost when the mind is brought down by grief. So that's Seneca's own take on this. So what is he providing us with here in these arguments and considerations? The key to human happiness from the Stoic perspective. We have to view virtues as the only good and stick with that idea. Then we have to act and organize one's life accordingly. It doesn't do any good to give lip service to, well, virtue is the only good, but I'm going to behave in a way inconsistent with that. And we have to do so in a world that is, you know, presumably governed by providence, but subject to fortune, with a mind inside of a body. And there's one consideration that he brings up here. He says, somebody could object. Doesn't the wise person experience something similar to emotion? Won't his color change, his expression show signs of alarm, his limbs grow cold, all those sorts of things? And Seneca says, yes, he will, but he will remain unchanged in his conviction that not one of the objects mentioned is bad or that such that a sound mind should quail at it. Everything that's to be done, he'll do promptly and boldly. So we have bodies and they're going to act in certain ways, but we don't have to go along with that. We can still behave virtuously. And if we do so, we will in fact be happy according to the Stoic conception of happiness. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.